Welcome to Living Waters Church, a community with Jesus at the center, shaped by scripture, dependent on his spirit, following together. For more resources, information, and news, check out our website, lwchurch.ca, and get connected.
Hi, folks. Good to be with you. My name is Luke. I'm on the team, and we're continuing today as we come to the end of our time in Paul's letter to the church in Thessalonica. Here we are in the thick of the summer, and no doubt that some of us have been hitting picnics and pools. And for those to whom it applies, I hope that some of us have been able to hit that out-of-office button after sending that final email right before a well-deserved break. If you've ever received one of those pre-vacation emails, you can often sense a slightly perkier tone with an extra exclamation mark or maybe smiley face here and there. It's almost as if we all know that there is more to life than email. Thank God. The other thing I've noticed about those emails is that they tend to also include a short list of prompts or details. Things like, so-and-so is handling this while I'm away, keep this in mind, don't worry about that, those sorts of things. And these are not unimportant scraps, but they're an example of someone who cares and actually wants things to go well while they're away. In other words, what we read in the postscript of any correspondence can be just as important as the ongoing body of work. It's often a distilled reflection of the main. And if at this point you're wondering if this entire sermon will be some strange exposition on the content and tone of email, fear not. I do have a point here. Because signing off, final important details, care being taken, this is exactly the point we've come to in the Apostle Paul's letter to his Thessalonian friends. After everything that we've heard in the letter so far, Paul is about to wrap things up. But a little like that final email before heading off, Paul has a few very key things to impress. And as is the case of many of Paul's letters, this tends to take some time because Paul really does care. Scholars tell us that Paul sometimes has a hard time wrapping his letters up. You can see that if you read them. And that's not because he's a scatterbrain, disorganized, but because when you're saying farewell to someone you love, you tend to take your time. And you will say, even if it means repeating yourself, what you're desperate for them to hear. And this is what we'll find in this final portion of 1 Thessalonians that we're covering this week, as I share this week and next week, and then Rick Watts concludes in a couple weeks from now. Recently in the letter, we've heard Paul give instruction on sisterly and brotherly love in the community and how this relates to ordinary things, ordinary life together. He's also shared on really how to approach the problem and the pain of death from a Christian perspective, all colored with a great deal of hope. So the back half of the letter, as we've been learning, is highly practical and it's highly personal. And if you've missed those talks, you can always listen online. What Paul shares in these concluding words is both in line with the rest of the letter, that is, it's particular to the church in Thessalonica, but it's also general and it's fairly consistent across his writing. We've noted earlier in this series that 1 Thessalonians was probably the first document written in what we now call the Bible's New Testament to the first church planted in what we now call Europe, somewhere around 50 AD. So the question is, what do we see emphasized among these first Christians at the end of a very early letter like this? You know, beginnings and endings are especially important to pay attention to in things like literature or even film. And this goes for Paul's letters in the New Testament too. What do we hear at the beginning and what are we hearing at the end that we should pay attention to? Well, here's a portion of our reading today. Paul says this in verse 12 of chapter 5. Now we ask you, brothers and sisters, to acknowledge those who work hard among you, who care for you in the Lord, and who admonish you. Hold them in the highest regard in love because of their work. Live in peace with each other. You know, after all that talk about email, forgive me for reminding us that Paul did not exactly have access to the internet in the first century. The letter we're reading was carried in person to Thessalonica and was read aloud in the hearing of the whole community, likely in a large enough home which fit the group, with the letter then being explained further by the carrier as questions arose. So imagine for a moment sitting among your fellow Christians in first century Thessalonica, hearing these words from Paul and everyone bearing the weight of them together. There were probably some kind of darting glances here or there across the room as folks were encouraged and challenged by some of what Paul was saying. And I imagine that there may have been a few extra looks exchanged at this part was read, because for the first time in the letter, Paul speaks of a particular kind of person in the church in Thessalonica at that time. Those who work hard among you, who care for you in the Lord, and who admonish you. In other words, those who were leading in this new Jesus community. A few things stand out in these brief words, which are some of the earliest words about some form of leadership in the early church. But let's begin by recognizing first that our own experience of leadership, my experience, your experience, both good and bad, has the potential to color how we read words like these. And because leadership cultures have at times become about the prominence or the ego of the leader themselves, it's important to hear what Paul is and is not saying here. Because at first glance, it might sound like Paul is emphasizing a reverence for those who are doing the leading. But a closer read reveals that overblown esteem is not at all his point. Consider, in fact, that we have heard nothing about the importance of leaders or the structure of leadership in this letter until this point. In fact, those leading are really only mentioned here as Paul is about to lay out a number of imperatives or essentials for the whole community to receive, which those leading are no doubt simply expected to model and apply in the community. So these few words about our attitudes towards spiritual leadership are not about church leaders getting a special spotlight or praise. Let's continue on that vein of thought. Notice what else is and isn't going on as Paul speaks of those leading. We don't hear a focus on positions or structures. Paul doesn't seem anxious about that stuff, but only attitudes and activity. More pointedly, we see Paul qualifying hard work, or what's translated labor, as an indicator of a leader. As one scholar puts it, those who are recognized and esteemed as leaders are characterized first as working hard at it. So, leadership that is Christian is discussed not in context of the importance of a position, but an expectation of hard work. And what is the hard work of leading in a Christian setting? Caring. Caring for those you are among in the Lord. This is a very clear and early example that leadership in the first Christian settings like these wasn't about visibility or status, but instead diligence and grit in caring for your fellow sisters and brothers. And as we see here, of course, sometimes caring meant admonishing or warning. Sincerely caring for someone means that if they're heading in a dangerous direction, you will patiently warn or gently warn to help correct their course. So care and warning combined here is no surprise, as Paul has already modeled this kind of thing in the main body of the letter. It's striking that for all the ideas out there about leadership in our world today, many of which have crept into the church over time, in the earliest stuff we dig up in the New Testament, we find a picture of individuals who first simply worked hard at caring for others in the Lord. And notice also that even when Paul says, hold them in the highest regard, he includes in love and because of their work. In other words, those leading are to be appreciated in love just as fellow brothers and sisters in the community share love, like everyone else. Obviously not to be treated as worse. And again, they aren't held in a loving or high regard because of some special rank, but because of their labor, what you can see them doing already. In these small house churches, the earliest Christian leaders were not acknowledged or listened to because they held a mysterious status, but because of their function among their fellow Christians and what following a good example would accomplish in the community. They were to be followed, you could say, based on the quality and character of their labor of love, not on the basis of some over-elevated position. You might notice at Living Waters that we tend to shy away from titles and an overemphasis on structure when possible. And that is in part because we think that it's far less important that we call or esteem anyone as leader or even pastor out of respect for a role in itself, and far more important that we simply all focus together on following the good examples of Jesus among us, whatever role we each play. A leader among us will simply be a good example of that quality of hardworking care, reflecting God's character. As we learn later in some of Paul's other letters, positions and titles are just not the point. Under Jesus, it doesn't matter a lick what title we hold, because Jesus puts all this aside and just serves by humble example. Notice also here that even when Paul asks, and he does ask, he doesn't demand, when he asks these early Christians to acknowledge and esteem those leading, it's always in this, you could say, equalized tone. And it seems to be Paul's template, as lifted from Jesus, that the model of Christian leadership is simply someone who works hard at applying the sticky mortar of love in building up the believing community. There's no talk of someone being a great strategist or a great speaker or some religious version of a slick CEO. Structures and organization in the church have naturally taken various forms throughout history. Working hard at caring for people does mean applying certain kinds of things. But there's a reminder here that an overemphasis on positions or hierarchy isn't Paul's concern, and that seems to be something he's pulled from Jesus. And as those first Christians in Thessalonica heard, we will know a leader is really a Christian leader first by their hard work of care among us. Any other approach to Christian leadership ends up being, sadly, not very Christian. You know, this week, we're saying goodbye to some folks in our church that some of us know, but many of us might not know, Cam and Nan. They're two people who have been good examples among us for years of what Christian leadership looks like. They've served in life groups on good days and bad. They're full of care and encouragement for those around them. They are easy, joyous, dare I say, fun examples to follow. And our team, young as many of us are at the church, can bear witness to their example. Cam and Nan have always been gracious. They've never aimed for praise or position. Instead, for years, we've watched them come to the church on a weekday, pick up a big bag of coffee-stained tablecloths from Sunday, take them home to be washed, and then bring them back later in the week. These folks have served in very important positions in various Christian settings over many decades. But as a young pastor growing up here, my enduring memory of them will be of their enthusiasm to serve and a genuine care for me personally. A real leader in Jesus' community cares little about status or visibility. What they care about is applying themselves to care for those around them in the Lord. Next, we hear Paul say this, live in peace with each other. And we urge you, brothers and sisters, warn those who are idle and disruptive, encourage the disheartened, help the weak, be patient with everyone. Make sure that nobody pays back wrong for wrong, but always strive to do what is good for each other and for everyone else. With the insistence that the sisters and brothers follow the lead of those working to care, now comes a list of imperatives, or we could say essentials, that everyone, under some good examples, should adopt. And some of this is Paul circling back to what's already come in the letter. And some of this is very early examples of what any Christian group should prioritize. First, we hear the phrase, live at peace with each other. And that's better connected with the previous line of thought, acknowledging those who are leading. Basically, Paul is saying that his hope is for churches that he's planted is that peace would be the focus. So for Paul, no divisive stuff going on, but instead a harmony among the believers. And this is true of any healthy Christian setting. As great as any individual melody might be, there is no substitute for harmony. And it certainly sounds awful when someone's attempt at a melody is actually a shouting above the rest who are trying to harmonize. We should aim to be at peace with one another, not in competition with one another or battling one another, if we do in fact claim to be Jesus' family. Following this, Paul lists five activities for the Thessalonians to prioritize. Remember, this group is very young in their faith. They face some tough challenges, including Paul having to leave them quickly, having only been with them for a month, and then they faced severe opposition in their city. So what does Paul prescribe? What's imperative to life together in Jesus, in a church that has this little experience and is only just forming? Well, as we've covered already in the letter, we won't rehash all of this, but all the sisters and brothers who can, first we hear, should contribute and be constructive, not the alternative, being idle or disruptive. When everyone contributes and when everyone aims to be constructive, we're on the right path. And this is a good aim for any of us in church. We're willing to contribute as able. We're not simply coming with a consuming mindset. And we're also being constructive with one another rather than disruptive or destructive. Second, notice that there's a real concern for those who are disheartened. Encourage the disheartened, Paul says. Why some are struggling, we don't really know. Maybe the pressure is mounting as they face persecution. Maybe they expected something different in Christian life. Scholars list a number of possibilities. But what I find striking is that here in one of the first ever churches, some folks are disheartened. They're not all constantly grinning at one another with immaculate smiles. So we know that the disheartened were first of all present, that they were also acknowledged, and that the community is told to do something to help, to encourage those who are struggling. It bears saying then that maybe we don't have to put on a brave face or turn up with an immaculate smile in order to belong in church. The disheartened are present among us right now for a variety of reasons. You know, I've been disheartened at times these past few months, and no doubt you have too on certain days. What we might be learning here is that being disheartened isn't something that we need to ignore or hide as a Christian, nor, as we also see here, do we have to let it get totally on top of us, because Paul's instruction is that others should come around to encourage when the going gets tough. And we can do that for each other. We can do that. That's what I've been grateful for in my experience of this church, and why I think we should always aim to be, yes, an authentic, but an encouraging kind of people. You'd hope that those around you first kind of make room for the possibility that things are not always sunny as a Christian, and then to stand at the ready to encourage when your heart is discouraged, disappointed, or heavy. You know, and this probably doesn't sound like a slap on the back with a chin up, Jesus loves you, have some faith kind of approach. Anyone who's been disheartened and then has simply been told not to be can testify that this approach doesn't feel very encouraging. Encouragement probably first makes some room for someone's experience and then includes speaking a kind of truth in love. So one gift that we might ask the Lord to give all of us is more of a gift of encouragement, because we know how often we can put that to work for one another in love. Encourage the disheartened. Thirdly, and similarly, Paul also says to help the weak. Again, we have no idea what kind of weakness he's referring to, maybe in body or in spirit, but the fact that weakness is present and is not to be shamed or ignored, but is to be helped, is this undergirding Christian value, again, very novel in the ancient world. You didn't help the weak in that world. There's no advantage to helping the weak for you. There's no advantage gained in that. But here, among the first Christians, weakness is not looked down on or despised, but attended to in one another. Are we disheartened or weak? No need to hide it or be ashamed of it. As sisters and brothers, do we have our eyes and ears open for one another who might be struggling this week or month or year? That's the caring work of the community. How we look out for one another in the Lord. How we look after one another in the Lord. Fourth, we hear, be patient with everyone. And that one's easy, so no need to go on. Well, of course not. Patience with everyone. Surely, as I read that, I thought, there must be a typo or a problem with the translation, because I find it's much easier to apply patience selectively to a few people in ideal conditions when it's most convenient for me. But this is no typo. Be patient with everyone, including the disheartened, including the weak. What's helpful to note is that the word translated here as patience is not the usual word Paul uses for patience. In other settings, the word he uses relates to kind of a difficult circumstance, being patient in or with a situation. The word translated as patience here is a different word, probably better translated long-tempered or long-suffering. One scholar says this word carries the sense of suffering long with regard to someone else. So this is a personal and relational kind of patience. And that, I think, is encouraging in itself. There's an expectation that in Christian community, with everyone in that community, a long-suffering patience will be asked of us. I will need from you a long-suffering patience in our dynamic, and so will you from me. So when it feels a bit hard going at times in church or in any Christian relationship, like marriage or in parenting, that's no reason to assume things are going wrong. In any Christian relationship, to be qualified as Christian at all, we can expect to need a good dose of long-suffering patience with one another. And that might make us breathe a sigh of relief, because a hill can be easier to climb when you're prepared for the grade, not constantly disappointed or frustrated. It shouldn't be like this. The Lord is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, and rich in love. We hear in Psalm 145, generous patience is at the heart of the character of God towards humanity all throughout the scriptures. It's in Jesus repeatedly in the Gospels. As Jesus' followers, through the power of the Holy Spirit, why would we not expect this kind of patience to be developed in us too? Fifthly and finally, Paul reminds them that if they're following Jesus, there can't be any vengeful payback among them. Grudges that turn septic into destructive behavior or just good old-fashioned revenge has no place among them as children of God. They're not meant to keep score or even the score. If they're going to follow a crucified and forgiving Lord, revenge isn't going to fly. We have to let go of that, even when it hurts. Instead, as we heard, do what is good for each other, including, and this is striking also, when it comes to those outside of the believing community. We know already from the book of Acts that some Christians in Thessalonica were harmed, maybe even killed. The kindness and generosity of God, the good willed and worked out for everyone we rub shoulders with, is the name of the game for a Christian community. Hearing all of that, this kind of whole line of thought feels very like Jesus, doesn't it? Which is only natural, as Paul, coming to the end of the letter, so committed to his Lord and deeply caring about his friends, wants them to hear the heart and character of Jesus as clear as day. What does it look like to be sisters and brothers in Jesus? What is Paul emphasizing as he begins to close this first letter to his friends? Well, sisters and brothers in Jesus will live at peace with each other. They'll be constructive and contribute. They'll encourage each other when they're disheartened. They'll help one another when they're weak. They'll climb the steep but rewarding hill of relationship with generous patience. They won't keep or level scores, and they'll do good to any and all around them. Now, sometimes you hear about churches who do all this intense strategic work and developing missions or purpose statements and things like that. And there's room for that. But you do wonder if a list like that might simply be the best place to start and then to aspire to. Because this sort of community doesn't automatically appear. It's hard won through genuine love. It's fueled by the Holy Spirit as we learn to love one another as Jesus has loved us. May God bless you and keep you this week as you love as God has loved you.
Thanks for joining today. If you'd like to get more connected or involved in any way, please reach out. We'd love to help. Have a great week.